All the time. We rely on it. It's a way that we can introduce foreign DNA into both eukaryotic cells and prokaryotic cells. We can create mutations. And in the classic genetic phase, recombination was used to map the distance between mutations and document. Borrelli's probably talked about that a little bit. Okay, so there's three general categories. There's autologous recombination. We'll spend some time on that, just the basic steps and models. Proteins are important, how we use it. Non-homologous recombination doesn't occur as often and involves short sequences of homology as opposed to homologous recombination, which requires longer sequences of homology between the DNA. And then illegitimate recombination is what transposons use, and that's a new chapter, but we can cover that today. So, homologous recombination, then, I think you've had enough background that everybody knows what I'm talking about so far, right? Okay, so for this to occur, there has to be homologous sequences between the two pieces of DNA, the two DNA molecules that are going to recombine. And it must be at least 23 base pairs, if there's one or two, for it to occur. At all in the detectable level, the more homologous, the longer the length of the region,
more likely that recombination will occur. So if you're trying to get it to happen in the lab, you want to have long sequences that are similar. Alright, and so on one strand then recombines with another. So here's the homology here. They're only held together by hydrogen bonds. And this area where they cross is called the synapse. So it's coming, it's going to come down. So this is a long stretch. This is my recombination hole. I get it every year. Trust it, Dr. Merrily, let me get out of it, but I won't do it. Okay. So then branch migration is really important in that. Extends the area of the heteroduplex. So this is what you saw before here. And then as it moves down, then you have a longer length of heterogeneous molecules pairing with each other. And again, these are only held by hydrogen bonds. It moves along here. The longer you let this occur, then the more exchange that will occur. And this requires some specialized proteins, which I'll talk about, called the RUV proteins, RUV. And all of this is in chapter 10 of your textbook. And the RUV proteins then are ATP hydrolyzing proteins. And they break existing hydrogen bonds here and reform new ones. And it allows this whole thing to go faster. Okay, when that happens, if there is place where they're not exactly matched. For example, here we have the orange molecule as an AT here, and the green molecule is a GC. You can get mismatched here, and this can be corrected, or it can be passed on to future daughter cells. So that's another time that diversity can happen. And again, the longer the length of your recombination or your synapse, the longer that heteroduplex is, the more chance that this is going to happen. And then the last step then is resolution of that duplex. And so we're going to look at some ways that this structure can isomerize, give you a couple different options on how it can actually be cut. And I'm going to show you this thing. I downloaded it first. Okay, so here we have starting to form heteroduplex. So if you look at these, what you want to look at are the markers. So if your markers are genes, so here's markers. So now you have your synapse. Do then is I summarize that, be two different ways, and one way, one set of strands are crossed, the other way another set of strands is crossed. Okay, so you have a 50% chance of it going either way. The position it's in when it resolves, when enzymes come in to cut it and be ligates, makes a difference in terms of what the outcome is. Scenario, then you have a combination of red paired with blue. Okay, so we'll go through the models about this and how you, where it's, where, when you get this outcome versus the other. Here's your isomerization. Is this review for most people? So again, this is very basic. I just want as many people as possible to really understand it, because it'll really help you in your courses later on to know this really well. Okay, so this one first person to really study this was a guy named Robin Holiday in 1964. He came out with a model called the Holiday Junction model. And here we have two molecules of DNA. The markers here are A and B. So pretend these are genes. For example, this is a urease gene. This is a tryptophan synthase gene, something like that. So the advantages of having genes that are enzymes is it's really easy to follow their function. And then you can follow where they go because they have a function that's easy to measure. So here we have the crossover synapse formation. And then we get the isomerization. This way, and then when it resolves, if it cuts like this, then we get recombination, we get new information, new species of DNA. And if it resolves like this, then here you get a patch, and here you get exchange of the actual markers here. This is automated, isn't it? All right, so what he thought, the way this worked, was that it was initiated by two single-stranded breaks that were made exactly in the same position, and then they thread in there. So this whole molecule had a break here, and then one strand threads in, and this whole molecule had a break there, and the other strand threads in, and that's this occurs. And that seems kind of unlikely. I think people pretty much accept from here on out is being right, but this initial step then is what different models have been proposed to explain, and that's in your textbook pretty well. Okay, so one model then is the single strand invasion model. And in this case, what's proposed is that one of the molecules actually has a hook. And three single strands, and then can actually enter into the other molecule, invade into the other molecule. And this gap here then is filled in by the DNA thermites. Yes. When that happens, this guy is displaced. This is called a D loop. In this model, it's degraded. And then eventually these two ends are joined. So you have crossover, you have different parents here as well as on both strands. As the branch generation occurs, that increases the length of these heteroduplex areas. This is in the textbook. Okay, the other model then is a double strand break repair model. And in this case, they propose, and they've shown experimentally that this can occur, that a double strand break occurs in one strand. They don't know how it hopefully doesn't fall apart, but this is the model. And one of the strands then invades this strand. And here, this display strand, the D loop, comes up and helps serve as the template to repair this. And in this case, two holiday junctions are formed, and then they're cut. And you can actually see holiday junctions in their electron microscope. Okay, so what are some of the important enzymes that are used in so this is important to know because a lot of the kits that you buy to help you do food, so really smart people understand this stuff very well. So capitalize on the different things to make your life easier. Okay, throw in the echo here, bring this out to make it easier to force recombination. So the most important enzyme by far is BRCA. So the way this table is, this is the mutation, and this is the phenotype cell based on E. coli. The phenotype that E. coli has if you carry this mutation. E. coli that lack red A, then our recombination is deficient. Red BC is also important, but not essential like red A. And if you have red D, which I'll explain later, is part of a B
ABCD complex, and it doesn't need time studies. We'll talk about this a little bit later. So let's see some how would you do this. So let's say your job, you've given a new vaccine that no one's working for, and you want to find out what genes are important for tumor genes constantly. What would you do? Genetics class, the answer is always if you are a graduate student, you're walking to audit someone, hands you a meeting, you're going to get done a lot faster than if you go in there and say, find something, and you have to make the meeting. Meetings are powerful. Now I'm looking for the slide that's going to be so, let's say it's not a hard bacterium, it's not one that we have to figure out how to mutate. We can use conventional methods. First second question that you need. Okay, so let's start with making mutant. So, gram negative. Okay, what are some ways that you can make mutants? Okay, you have to do that. Some species probably still you do. It works, but the drawback to that, you know, the drawback to this.
Thanks for going. Thank you.
will be named. So how do you get that to this building? Do that for? You can use a phage, so you can introduce it by way of horizontal exchange. And we know the bacteria used for destruction, transformation, and conjugation. So if you bring it in on a phage that can't integrate, you can bring it in on a plasmid, a phage. You could do naked DNA. That didn't work. It was just too technically too complex. So transformation is another way of doing it. We're not going to make it perfect. So let's go with a conjugate. Or just define something that you can do by making your strain of this. So you've got this paint to base on. Introduce this plasma in here. The plasmid can replicate inside the bacterium. And that can be the cell where it transforms into a cell. And so what they can do is they have a little marker on the plasmid. And to use a plasmid as a suicide, that can only come in those. And so they won't be able to replicate from the suicide. So they go in, but then you can swap and not replicate. We're looking for jumping in that transplant. That's what we're is useful because if you get ant resistant colonies, you want to make sure they're cancerous. Okay, so now we've got the colonies here. How many do you need to find mutants in genes in a collective recombination? 10? We've got a mutant bank, basically a mutant bank, and you can simply just stick them in a few years, and the ways you're going to put them in the microtiter plates and freeze them. Mutant bank. To help you, one or more of these can have reduced food elimination. Okay, now let's go to the acid, the screen. Right here,
So one way you can look for the determination is by conjugation. Again, with the suicide factors, because you don't want to just look for conjugation, you want to look for integration of dependency, recombination of dependency. So you're going to add another quantity. So it's like that, what needs to be on that toxin? What does that mean? Introduce this plasmid there. And what are you going to look for? You're going to introduce this plasmid to all these different mutants. A lot of work. And then you're going to screen all these mutants for iron resistance. Antibiotics are really easy to screen with. So you'll take plasmid can't replicate on its own. And you get some herb resistant ones back. So what would you use to confirm that recombination occurred in your locus? Urease activity. So you look for herb resistant urease negative colonies. Are not going to be mutated genes that are important for recombination. And so they're going to have a frequency of this occurring of something like 1 in 10,000 copies. This is something else everybody should be comfortable with. So on a genetic sense, the frequency is typically 1 in 10,000 genes in 2,000 copies. And let's say it's 10 to the minus 5. I think that's reasonable. Okay, let's say you get a mutant that you have that's ant-resistant. It's a mutant. It's also arm-resistant. This guy, it's recombination. We can see it's going to be, if it's in the rec aging, you can see 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100, 1 in 90. Resistant urease negative more frequently or less frequently? Less frequently.
Are black
an indoor silver prominent object that forms a three.
These would be recombinant positives. So this would be out of 1,000 mixes, and this would be 995 mixes for the fetus.
The majority ship.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the combination to not that.
Correct.
So if they sure. not enough. If they are making urine, then they may not pass the properties to that one.
Okay, all right. So then you have another mutant. We've done this. And you look and look and look, and you can't find any urine resistant breeds of the prominence. Except one out of the million. Okay. So this or this. Probably we can pull none of them on because it's not totally. So one mutant that we can never isolate these. Five mutants where we can never isolate these. If you do, it's really rare event. That's a good question. I don't advise it.
And you refer to them on how it's been.
So this guy would also be urine resistant, urease negative. Whether it's due to normal recombination, probably that happened. Maybe the urease gene spontaneously mutated and the plasmid went somewhere else, the urine resistant went somewhere else. You have to check that out. Or it could be low level recombination in the absence of regulation. So the way that this would be then is then wild type. Majority of the mutants. It's the majority of the mutants. Frequency of the 10 to minus 4. And then 5 out of 1,000. That's the frequency of the greater than 10 to minus. Is everybody kind of comfortable with this thought process? Like you have to have a screen, you have to have a way of testing each mutant, looking for loss of the phenotype that you're looking for. And then that is just the samples that you need to talk to because you can play it next to that you have a few different shots and different positions. Okay, so you've got this mutant now. Let's put it down here. Let's say you have a set of mutants. It's really bad. So I'll tell you that we have maybe one, two, and three. Have the frequency urine resistant urease negative polymers following this recombination conjugation. Okay, so here we have two of those. Or here we have 10 of the ones. Definitely this one gives you, I'm going to change these numbers a little bit just to make it easier. Here, let's say we have one of these mutants. So what would you predict about the genes that were hit in those three mutants? In terms of whether they're the same gene or different genes? So I think mutant 3 versus mutant 2 would be different genes or the same. One is has a 1,000-fold less frequency in combination. And two has a 1,000-fold decrease in frequency. And three is only 10-fold decrease. That's how you can kind of sort out what you want to go for. So you don't have time to look at two mutants, so you pick one and three. You don't pick one and two. It's one and two, but you're more likely to get different. how do you go about retrieving that nutrient gene? You definitely would have the email to then show that you hit an open income, that's a gene that you hit. How do you go about retrieving the nutrient gene? You have mutagenesis and all that, right, already? Right, so you got mutant number three. That's unique number one. Phenotype is reduced recombination efficiency using this conjugation basis. And it is arm resistant. It's also ink resistant because it's. Okay, which of these markers? You know, somewhere in this mutant, there is a gene with the amp resistant marker stuck in it. And how would you go about retrieving that gene? So you could, I think you're saying you'd recombine with. Has part of the amp resistance sequences on it. Okay, I think what that would do would replace this with amp sensitivity, right? So that's, people do that to make their strain not resistant anymore if you want to feed animals or people. But that doesn't pull the tweak out. How do you get that tweak out? You put it in testing. Okay, so yeah, it could. So you would have to have primers, right? So you can do primers. You're going to go this way, you might want to go this way. So the DNA that you're implanting is like this. So you can do that. It's kind of tricky.
Can you do an eye bag?
Yeah. It's usually not kind of digest. So you can make, cut this guy up. Enzymes. Pick one down, but don't hit that left one. Okay. And clone these fragments to help connect this. Let's say we pick 103. That's every 6 base pairs of a certain sequence, and we know there's no 103 states here. Chop it up a couple of ways. Okay, so now you've got a mutated gene here. Okay. So now what are you going to do? You really want the wild type gene, not the mutated gene. So now what could you do? Yep, you could assign primers to amp resistance. Not like what you were thinking. You just sequence this way, so you get some sequence information from your mind. That would give you primers to go back into a wild type chromosome and try to amplify opportunity. You might get some enough data here to feed it through a database to see if spawn was too right there of E. coli or something like that. Go back and make any three gene bank of wild type to use those primers inside of lots or some other technique to pull out all the carrying of the wild type gene. at a graduate level. You did pretty well. All right, so. Okay, so this is my attempt to show kind of what we talked about, making the leap of bank screen for that ability to do our free combination. And doing that then, lots and lots of hours, lots of graduate students picking colonies, doing matings, etc., they found, and I do not like this automated. They found all these genes. And again, the most important was rec A. And then the B, C, D complex, which we're going to talk about. So now let's talk about what we do. Okay, so we're going to start with B, C, D. Even though alphabetically it comes after A, it's the first enzyme that's important. And what this does, it binds to DNA at one end of a double-stranded breakage point, and it has a helicase activity, which helps unwind the DNA, which is important. And it also has an exonuclease activity that works from 3' to 5'. And so as it, this is from your textbook, this figure, as it moves along, then the helicase separates these strands, and the exonuclease degrades this. There are sites on the chromosome, so just scattered about, called chi sites. This is the Greek letter for chi. And when this passes this, the exonuclease activity is inhibited. The exonuclease portion of this complex is RecD. That's the exonuclease. And when that's inhibited then, this is what the chi sites are. It's an eight-base pair sequence. It doesn't have symmetry, but when they're present, recombinations increase to get better recombination. And that's because when this exonuclease then is inhibited, this becomes a free strand then that can feed in to another piece of DNA like this. And it's a figure in text, Raw chapter 10. So when I come back here, and we look at this, RecD, a RecD mutant is independent of chi sites. So if you have a RecD mutant, then whether chi sites are present or not, you get the same level of recombination. And that's because it lacks RecD, which is what the chi site is. And that's what's going to be on the chart. It's a chi-independent mutation. So then now we're talking about RecA then. So RecA is really important. And what it does is it binds to this free strand that was made by inhibiting the exonuclease activity of that strand. As the strands are opening up with the RecBCD and the exonuclease activity is inhibited, it's free. Okay, so the RecA binds that and stabilizes it. And it also makes a helical state, which positions the nucleotides so that they can form hydrogen bonds with the complementary strand, not buried so much. So it's really important. Okay, so that's RecA. And this you can see them here. It forms these kind of like coiled structures like that. And it is the most important protein. And so when you're making a mutant bank looking for loss of recombination ability, the most attenuating mutant will be in the RecA gene. And most bacteria have it. It doesn't matter what species you're working on. Okay, and then
then I have several others listed here, just, we don't need to know much about them, so just recognize that they're members of this set of enzymes. So these are important in DNA repair, and then the rub proteins, which we'll talk about. So in terms of things to really know, I would know REC-A, REC-BCD, and the rub proteins, ABC. The rest of these, just as you read and things, you'll see them, and there's a lot of information about them out there. But to really understand this, I think you just limit yourself to A, B, C, D, and the rub proteins of your eye. Okay, so the rub proteins then are important for branch language. We've already talked about them a little bit. Okay, so rub A then binds the holiday junctions. It lays out kind of like a flower shape, and that stabilizes it. And then rub B then is a helicase, which forms a ring around the strands and allows this branch to pump through the center. So here's rub A, stabilizes that, and then rub B forms these rings, and that allows the branch to move. And again, they're ATP hydrolases. And then rub C is a special endonuclease called an X-file, not F-I-L-E, H-I-L-E, and that's cross-free, and it will cleave that okay, so we get rub A stabilizing the synapse. We have rub B forming these tunnels through which the branch can move, and then you have rub C that will cleave this cross strand of DNA. And so bacteria that lack these proteins, then they don't have as extensive heteroduplex formation, and so recombination is not as efficient. You can't get long stretches of recombination occurring. And this is what it looks like in a proposed model. So you see here, synapse. This is rub A right here, and here's rub B, stabilizing this. So here is, I think the negative is this. So here is the chromosome on the top. It has two genes, A and B. And you have a heterogeneous space here. And you want to mutate these. And here you have the plasmid. You have this locus on the plasmid. And you've inserted an amp resistant gene in between them. I think Dr. Melissa, you went over crossovers with you and told you to learn how to draw them, follow the lines, right? So he's right, okay, so I'll help you later. So here's the initial crossover event. And I'm going to draw with the pointer how to do this. So I always start with the chromosome. I'm a little bit challenged with direction, so maybe you'd like to do this in private. So I'll try to do it here. You go like this. So you get a little bit of the A gene, the end of the A gene, and then the whole plasmid, and then the beginning of this recombinant A gene, which will then come at the end of this gene, and then the B gene will stay the same. So look like that. So you want to practice that. If you have trouble and you want to come visit me, that's fine. So that's a one single crossover event, and the result is you get integration of the whole plasmid into the chromosome and regeneration of the gene. Okay, so then a double crossover can occur. If the crossover occurs on the opposite side of your introduced marker here, you're in luck because you end up with the mutated codes. The way you do this is when you draw this, you bend this around and make the crossover occur between this B and this B, and you'll be able to draw it out. If the second crossover occurs on the same side, you end up with what you started with. If you're trying to make a mutant in which you disrupted this with this arm-resistant cassette in the middle, you're hoping that the crossover will occur on either side of the marker. Did he go through this with you? So I'll leave the slides and you can practice these different colored pencils. Just follow the lines. So when you're reading papers and people make mutants and do fancy things with DNA, if you don't know how to do this, you just have to take their word for it. Otherwise, in the margin, you can draw it out and see if they should have got what they got or understand better what they're doing. And the design of a lot of mutagenesis systems relies on things like this happening. And so it's good to be able to do it and understand it better when you actually get to techniques. Okay, so let's say you don't want to go through all this. You want to just get your mutant. And you want to have a mutation in gene A. So what you do then is you take the 5' end of the gene and you clone it onto a plasmid. You look for a crossover event. And here you have the plasmid comes in, but you get regeneration of the gene. So you have a mutated gene, but also an intact copy. And I'll tell you, sometimes that's useful. I'll tell you why. If you use an internal fragment to the gene and you follow the lines, what you end up with is a true mutant in gene A. So if you do this bottom one, you don't have to look for a second crossover. If you do the middle one, there are times when you want the function of the gene that you want to study, for example, its promoter. So I'm going to tell you that in a second. So do I should put this first here. So this you should know really well. Here, you want to remember that if you just want to mutate a gene, you can just use the internal fragment and result in a mutated gene. And not have to get a second crossover. An example of when you would use the 5' end then is here. Okay, remember there's going to be a promoter right here? Let's say you want to study the strength of that promoter, but you don't want to disrupt the function of gene A. So here you use the 5' end of the gene. And you end up with, you have, for example, a reporter gene and a plasmid hooked to the 5' end of the gene. You'll end up with this reporter construct on your chromosome that uses the promoter for gene A, plasmid integrates, but then here you've regenerated a functional gene A. So you can study the promoter strength without losing the function. Instances where that's important to what you're doing. All right, let's take a little break and we'll talk about site-specific recombination. That's maybe 5 after 2.
More intelligent than I am.
A lot of questions. So, on this first one, I think it would help if I explain what the goal is first. So, on this top example, let's say you have a bacteria. This is the part of the chromosome here. So, this is a wild type bacteria. This is part of the chromosome. You want to get between these two genes. So, what you do then is you clone that locus onto a plasmid and you put the amp resistance gene before that. And so when I say the recombinant copy of A, what I mean is the copy that you clone. This is the wild type copy, this is the recombinant copy. And recombinant usually has a prime after it, that's how they usually designate it. Recombinant copy of B. So what you should be able to do is with the single crossover. Be able to draw crossing over here and ending up with that. Everybody should be able to do that.
point. So now, this isn't exactly what we wanted, because you've got all this plasma sequence in here. You've got ERM resistance in here. You don't want ERM resistance in here. You really just want something that looks like this. And so the second crossover, to be able to follow that, if it occurs on the same side as the first, you're going to end up with what we started with. What you want is that second crossover event to occur on the other side of your marker. The way that you try and do that is on a piece of paper, draw this whole thing out, and then bend this like a U-shape, and draw the crossover between the recombinant bean and the wild-type bean that would be on the other side of the marker, or between this A and one of these A's, and one of these A's here. And when you do that, you should get this, if it's on the other side of the marker, which is what your desired construct is. That's now bacterium. It carries an amp-resistant marker in that locus. It doesn't have plasma DNA anymore. That's what you want. Or you can have this. Okay. This next example is just skip. So down here, this is another way of mutating genes, and it has the advantage in that you don't have to get the double crossover to get rid of plasmid or to get a mutated gene. And so you draw this up, and this is just the internal fragment. It doesn't have the N-terminus, it doesn't have the C-terminus. So you end up with a hybrid gene that has the N-terminus of the wild-type gene, part of the internal fragment of the recombinant piece in the plasmid, the other part of the internal fragment of the recombinant piece, and the C-terminus of the wild-type gene, or the 3' terminus of the wild-type gene. This is mutated because neither one of those is functional. Neither one of those is a full-length gene. Okay, just playing around.
So it's all purposes just to knock out genes then?
Right.
That's flexible.
Yeah, so then the last couple slides are how you use recombination in the wild. Or how you figure out something happened in nature. And the end result, what must have happened? This recombination led to this, this recombination went with this. So now let's talk about non-homology site specific recombination. So, this is different than homologous recombination. You don't need to know. What this involves are particular sequences that are on the target and on the domain. And they're specific sequences, and because they're not very long, they're not always 100% matched. They require special enzymes to catalyze the events that are required for these sequences. This doesn't happen that much compared to all this recombination. It happens all the time. So there's two best basic ways this can be. One can be intermolecular between strands, different strands or different molecules. As an example, a phage coming into the chromosome. They're the classic example, and the enzymes that they use to perform this are called integrases. They recognize a sequence on the phage, a sequence on the target DNA, the bacterial chromosome, and allow recombination to occur. And then you have non-homologous recombination that is intramolecular and occurs within the same DNA molecule and the chromosome. And here we have different kinds of enzymes. One class is called resolvases, and they pair sequences that are similar to each other and in a direct orientation. Invertases then pair sequences that are in reverse orientation to each other. And we'll go through a specific example. So let me go down. So this one, integrases, have phage. Site does not intensely exploited in the resale, expenses, DNA. United in that causes transcription of genes that are required for sporulation. It doesn't matter because the mother's helping the dominant and the spores administered on it. So there are instances in there where it occurs. But once this DNA is lost, it's lost. And it may occur if this DNA is essential, then you have to be like transcription. Okay, at the bottom one, invertase, then that occurs when you have indirect repeats or reverse repeats. So here you have this. So these we combine and this leaves that to get the version. So this goes the other way. It's beautiful. And it's reverse. And we'll talk about the classic of medical math, which is phage, or vaginal phase variation. Hopefully, when we read the chapter, it's this stuff's kind of hard. This will start making more sense. Try to see the highlights. Okay, so for phage, then, we're talking about intermolecular recombination. It occurs by way of integrases. Everybody remembers the lytic lysogenic lifestyles of phages, right? So what we're talking about is how this stage can come in and become a prophage. How does it integrate into the chromosome here? And then how it expresses. So the integration then is by way of the phagement enzyme, the integrases. Occurs by way of a site on the phage called the ATTP site, the phage. And the bacteria on the chromosome is a site called the ATTP site, the bacteria. And those bind, I'll show you a picture in a second. And then when it excises, it needs that integrase in there, but it also has an excise base and it cut it out so it can go on its merry way. So this is the lambda genome. And the genes I'm talking about are the gene. So this is the integrase, allows the prophage to integrate. This is the excisase, which allows it to get out. And here's the ATTP site, which is, allows it to find a place on the chromosome, find its home on the chromosome. So here we have the ATTP and B sites, and they're similar in a 15 base pair region in the middle. So what the integrase does is it recognizes this and binds to this so that it can integrate. So here we have the chromosome, the bacteria, the phage. We get recombination here, binding here by virtue of the antiprotein that integrates in the wider level space. The decision and these sites are now recombinant sites, and we withdraw that recombination on it. We end up with slightly different ATT sites on each side. They will bind, and the antibodies together allows it to excise. I'm sorry, I don't think that's what we're doing. This is in chapter 9. This would be a figure like this is chapter 9. Okay, so let's do experimental again. So we talked about integrases, different molecules of DNA coming together. We talked a little bit about how DNA may excise from molecular, and now we'll talk about how we can get flipping of DNA. So this was discovered about 40 years ago, and we didn't really know what was going on. And what they found was that Salmonella would have two different flagellar types that were recognized by two different landmarks of the container part. And so, first, let me just put how it works. I'll get rid of this. So this is how it is. Here's the chromosome. Here we have the gene for the major subunit of flagella called flagellin. This particular antigenic type is called H2. It is driven by a promoter, which also drives the expression of a repressor gene downstream, which represses the production of a gene that encodes a second antigenic type of flagellin called H1, which is somewhere else on the chromosome. So when this gene is on, and this promoter is here, you get this made, this is made, and that turns off. Upstream of this gene are inverted repeats, and also a gene here that encodes an invertase called HIN. And when these guys recombine like that, this flips. Now the promoter is going this way, John second. So this is no longer made. The repressor is no longer made. So now this second type of flagellin can be made. This you want to know really well. This is just beautiful biology. It's just a classic textbook example of phase variation and the recombination of it. Alright, so
do you see an off button on it?
Enterobacteriaceae, so it's Paratrichus flagella, everybody knows that. Flagella have lots of subunits. The major subunit is a protein called flagellin. And you have cut this, you've taken the salmonella, you shear this flagella out, cut them out of the flagellin protein out of the cell, immunize them, and you have an antibody that recognizes this flagella. What are different kind of antibodies or assays you use to follow recognition of things like antibodies? The whole bacteria, what kind of assay you use to show that antibody binding down the
recognition?
And there's something in between there. Whole bacteria is going to be calling the boss. The reason we're dividing these up like this is we're looking to measure frequency in bacteria to know the difference to mark the acid that lets you know the effects of bacteria. So this guy is not going to work, right? You can't take every single bacteria into a restaurant with 10,000 lanes and see which one doesn't react with the antibody. colony box is sort of an intermediate. If you have a population of salmonella, you culture it on a plate. Every bacterium, single one that lands, makes a colony, and the majority will make this one particular type of flagellum. The frequency of going from this type to another is about 10 to the minus 4. Your textbook says 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 4. So every 100 to 10,000 colonies will switch to the other type of flagella. A colony has about, for salmonella, about 10 to the 8th colony forming units. So about 10,000 or more will have the other kind of flagella, which you still won't detect as much because 7 and fewer than what remains. But this guy lets you look at lots of individual bacteria. Okay, so this is a good way for screening how many out of 1,000 are on. So what they found was that every 100 to 10,000 salmonella that had flagellum on, flagellum 1, every 10,000 or so there was one that didn't react with that antibody anymore. So I'm going to draw this out again so make sure everybody understands it. So they figured out where the locus was. The locus is that place in the DNA that contains the genes that encode this phenotype. Okay, in this locus, there's lots of flagella genes. One of them, the H1 flagella. Indirect repeats come together and are stabilized by this invertase. This flips and you end up with this intervening region flips. What you end up with is is still there, but it's going the other way, and if there's genes up here, maybe they're turning on that. So this is the one that I need. If the request was off, we set a gene in here. You have a bacterium that has an outer membrane protein. You've got an antibody to it, like one of its loops or something like that. You played out your bacteria one day, you do colony blots. And you look at the four different colonies with an antibody, one out of 10,000 does not react with the antibody. still making this protein though on a gel. So if you take this bacterium and you strip out the outer membrane and you run a gel, you still have the protein of the same size as what it's supposed to be. Our Western whisper doesn't react with the antibody either. The others do. So what could be responsible for that? Perhaps it's something like this, where you two alleles for arm X, one farther away. This one is next to a repressor of the other one, and the upstream region of this is this one to turn it on and off. That's one scenario. How would you determine whether homologous recombination is required for this event? Genetics class, what's it? What kind of mutant would you make? Rec A gene. So you would know the rec A gene here. You would mutate the rec A gene here. And let's say you knew the sequence. It's really easy to just go in there and mutate it. So now you look and see if still out of 10,000 colonies, do you still get one that changes? If you do, then it's rec A independent. And that suggests it's site specific recombination, perhaps, or some other mechanism. It's fun, isn't it? Science is fun. When you're not tested on it, it's fun. Okay. And that's all I have. So,
what is the franchise that can produce on production? Is it promoted?
It has its own promoted. So, one other question is to be asked. I thought about this, I wasn't going to do it. Another question to be asked, is it spontaneous, is it low level, or is it induced? So let's say this bacterium makes a lot more of it, and we go to specific frequency, and induced too. It's kind of like this fork in vitro. Let's make it something around there. Let's make it Malthus. Malthus is a respiratory gas. The pulse surface like that are very starved in iron. And let's say you have a mouse model of the Malthus, and you've got them growing in the lung of this mouse. And when you measure this with an in vivo grown Malthus, you get a frequency that's the same one back. Would suggest that there's an environmental factor that is cranking up that invertase, right? Perhaps it's iron, low iron. Have you had fur in it? Some fur? This idea, some people live for so, anyway, so that suggests there's an environmental factor that is acting on that hinge to make it make more of it. Maybe that increases the amount of times this happens. So how would you figure that out, since we've got some time? We know this has its own promoter. Okay, so now you have the hypothesis that the expression of N is upregulated in vivo. How do you measure promoter strength? Right, fusions, transcriptional fusions. Correct. So you would clone this out and put a reporter gene in there. You can interrupt the gene, it doesn't matter. Let's make it get through. Make a lactamase or something like that. And then you grow this in the mouse and in vitro and measure the amount of this reporter. And if it's increased in vivo, then you're like, hey, this is right. This is increased more in vivo. What's the exact signal? Go back to the lab, try low iron, try different amino acids, whatever might be in that respiratory tract that's different. Some other body site pH maybe makes a difference. This is a case where you might want to keep that hint functional and still have a reporter construct elsewhere, and then you would use that crossover with the 5' end of the gene, that middle panel that I wish I hadn't brought up until I talked about the bottom. Just to summarize then, so today, you want to know how to draw a fiber structure,
I only know the three models of strand breakage. I don't know the difference between homologous and site-specific recombination. There's 23 or more base pairs of homologous versus specific sites that are shorter. I don't know Rec A, FBCD, and drug proteins. I'm going to ask what their function were. You need to draw them on a picture of the synapse, how you draw them. And the facile at making a mutant and looking for ones that aren't able to do recombination as well. What would be your assay? How would you go about making a mutant? And you might retrieve the wild type gene. I would be able to draw a recombination event that uses plasmin, a recombinant gene, a recombinant gene, plus another with the chromosome. What happens when it's an alternate versus a nuclear fragment versus the 5-prime? It's a whole gene, you need to be able to do the first crossover and the second crossover and choose the biology. You have colored pencils really help. And the site-specific, I think the lambda page example is classic for the health play this game, so that would be the interferences, those types of enzymes. And I don't know the flagella stuff. This is just a really good example. And try to think experimentally when you get in there to think about how would I show you the side of the Texas? How would I measure this? That was the question. Am I going to have a sensitivity and need to find what I'm looking for? How use your fasting. What are your markers? I think you guys are great. I love my reaction in this one. Thank you. So the slides are on hand. It's called Recombination 2007.